Chapter 4. A. Well then, Monsieur Mutual, what do I know, what can I say? I assure you that he calls himself Monsieur the Englishman. Pardon, but I think it is impossible, said Monsieur Mutual, a spectacled, snuffy, stooping old gentleman in carpet shoes, and a cloth cap with a peaked shade, a loose blue frock coat reaching to his heels, a large limp white shirt frill, and cravat to correspond. That is to say, white was the natural color of his linen on Sundays, but it toned down with the week. It is, repeated Monsieur Mutual, his amiable old walnut-shell countenance very walnut-shelly indeed as he smiled, and blinked in the bright morning sunlight. It is, my cherished Madame Bauclet, I think, impossible. Hey! With a little vexed cry, and a great many tosses of her head. But it is not impossible that you are a pig, retorted Madame Bauclet, a compact little woman of 35 or so. See then, look there, read. On the second floor, Monsieur Langlois. Apostrophe, is it not so? It is so, said Monsieur Mutual. Good. Continue your morning walk. Get out. Madame Bauclet dismissed him with a lively snap of her fingers. The morning walk of Monsieur Mutual was in the brightest patch that the sun made in the Grand Place of a dull old fortified French town. The manner of his morning walk was with his hands crossed behind him, an umbrella, in figure the express image of himself, always in one hand, a snuffbox in the other. Thus, with the shuffling gait of the elephant who really does deal with the very worst trousers maker employed by the zoological world, and who appeared to have recommended him to Monsieur Mutual, the old gentleman sunned himself daily, when sun was to be had of course, at the same time sunning a red ribbon at his buttonhole, for was he not an ancient Frenchman? Being told by one of the angelic sex, to continue his morning walk and get out, Monsieur Mutual laughed a walnut-shell laugh, pulled off his cap at arm's length with the hand that contained his snuff-box, kept it off for a considerable period after he had parted from Madame Bauclet, and continued his morning walk and got out, like a man of gallantry as he was. The documentary evidence to which Madame Bauclet had referred Monsieur Mutual was the list of her lodgers, sweetly written forth by her own nephew and bookkeeper, who held the pen of an angel, and posted up at the side of her gateway, for the information of the police. O second, M. Langlois, proprietor. On the second floor, Mr. the Englishman, man of property. So it stood. Nothing could be plainer. Madame Bauclet now traced the line with her forefinger, as it were to confirm and settle herself in her parting snap at Monsieur Mutual, and so placing her right hand on her hip with a defiant air, as if nothing should ever tempt her to unsnap that snap, strolled out into the Place, to glance up at the windows of Mr. the Englishman. That were he happening to be looking out of window at the moment, Madame Bauclet gave him a graceful salutation with her head, looked to the right and looked to the left, to account to him for her being there, considered for a moment, like one who accounted to herself for somebody she had expected not being there, and re-entered her own gateway. Madame Bauclet let all her housekeeping on the Place in furnished flats or floors, and lived up the yard behind in company with Monsieur Bauclet, her husband, great at billiards, an inherited brewing business, several fowls, two carts, a nephew, a little dog in a big kennel, a grapevine, a counting house, four horses, a married sister with a share in the brewing business, the husband and two children of the married sister, a parrot, a drum performed on by the little boy of the married sister, two billeted soldiers, a quantity of pigeons, a fife played by the nephew in a ravishing manner, several domestics and supernumeraries, a perpetual flavor of coffee and soup, a terrific range of artificial rocks, and wooden precipices at least 4 feet high, a small fountain, and half a dozen large sunflowers. Now the Englishman, in taking his apartment, or, as one might say on our side of the channel, his set of chambers, had given his name, correct to the letter, Langley. but as he had a British way of not opening his mouth very wide on foreign soil, except at meals, the brewery had been able to make nothing of it but Langless. So Mr. the Englishman he had become and he remained. Never saw such a people, muttered Mr. the Englishman, as he now looked out of window. Never did, in my life. This was true enough, for he had never before been out of his own country, a right little island, a tight little island, a bright little island, a show-fight little island, and full of merit of all sorts, but not the whole round world. These chaps, said Mr. the Englishman to himself, as his eye rolled over the place, sprinkled with military here and there, are no more like soldiers. Nothing being sufficiently strong for the end of his sentence, he left it unended. This again, from the point of view of his experience, was strictly correct, for though there was a great agglomeration of soldiers in the town and neighboring country, you might have held a grand review and field day of them every one, and looked in vain among them all for a soldier choking behind his foolish stock, or a soldier lame by his ill-fitting shoes, or a soldier deprived of the use of his limbs by straps and buttons, or a soldier elaborately forced to be self-helpless in all the small affairs of life. A swarm of brisk, bright, active, bustling, handy, odd, skirmishing fellows, able to turn cleverly at anything, from a siege to soup, from great guns to needles and thread, from the broadsword exercise to slicing an onion, from making war to making omelets, was all you would have found. What a swarm! From the great plus under the eye of Mr. the Englishman, where a few awkward squads from the last conscription were doing the goose step, some members of those squads still, as to their bodies, in the chrysalis peasant state of blouse, and only military butterflies, as to their regimentally clothed legs, from the great plus, away outside the fortifications, and away 4 miles along the moldy roads, soldiers swarmed. All day long, upon the grass-grown ramparts of the town, practicing soldiers trumpeted and bugled. All day long, down in angles of dry trenches, practicing soldiers drummed and drummed. Every forenoon, soldiers burst out of the great barracks into the sandy gymnasium ground hard by, and flew over the wooden horse, and hung onto flying ropes, and dangled upside down between parallel bars, and shot themselves off wooden platforms. Splashes, sparks, coruscations, showers of soldiers. At every corner of the town wall, every guardhouse, every gateway, every sentry box, every drawbridge, every reedy ditch, and rushy dike, soldiers, soldiers, soldiers. And the town being pretty well all wall, guardhouse, gateway, sentry box, drawbridge, reedy ditch, and rushy dike, the town was pretty well all soldiers. What would the sleepy old town have been without the soldiers, seeing that even with them, it had so overslept itself, as to have slept its echoes hoarse, its defensive bars and locks and bolts and chains all rusty, and its ditches stagnant? From the days when Vauban engineered it to that perplexing extent that to look at it was like being knocked on the head with it, the stranger becoming stunned and stertorous under the shock of its incomprehensibility, from the days when Vauban made it the express incorporation of every substantive and adjective in the art of military engineering, and not only twisted you into it, and twisted you out of it, to the right, to the left, opposite, under here, over there, in the dark, in the dirt, by the gateway, archway, covered way, dry way, wet way, foss, portcullis, drawbridge, sluice, squat tower, pierced wall, and heavy battery, but likewise took a fortifying dive under the neighboring country, and came to the surface 3 or 4 miles off, blowing out incomprehensible mounds and batteries among the quiet crops of chicory and beetroot. From those days to these the town had been asleep, and dust and rust, and must had settled on its drowsy arsenals and magazines, and grass had grown up in its silent streets. On market days alone, its great plus suddenly leaped out of bed. On market days, some friendly enchanter struck his staff upon the stones of the great place, and instantly arose the liveliest booths and stalls, and sittings and standings, and a pleasant hum of chaffering and huckstering from many hundreds of tongues, and a pleasant, though peculiar, blending of colors, white caps, blue blouses, and green vegetables, and at last the night destined for the adventure seemed to have come in earnest, and all the Vaubanois sprang up awake. And now, by long, low-lying avenues of trees, jolting in white-hooded donkey cart, and on donkey back, and in tumbril and wagon, and cart and cabriolet, and afoot with barrow and burden, and along the dikes and ditches and canals, in little peak-proud country boats, came peasant men and women in flocks and crowds, bringing articles for sale. And here you had boots and shoes, and sweetmeats and stuffs to wear, and here in the cool shade of the town hall, you had milk and cream and butter and cheese, and here you had fruits and onions and carrots, and all things needful for your soup, and here you had poultry and flowers and protesting pigs, and here new shovels, axes, spades, and billhooks for your farming work, and here huge mounds of bread, and here your unground grain in sacks, and here your children's dolls, and here the cake seller, announcing his wares by beat and roll of drum. And hark, fanfaronade of trumpets, and here into the great place, resplendent in an open carriage, with four gorgeously attired servitors up behind, playing horns, drums, and cymbals, rolled the daughter of a physician in massive golden chains and earrings, and blue feathered hat, shaded from the admiring sun by two immense umbrellas of artificial roses, to dispense, from motives of philanthropy, that small and pleasant dose which had cured so many thousands. Toothache, earache, headache, heartache, stomachache, debility, nervousness, fits, fainting, fever, ague, all equally cured by the small and pleasant dose of the great physician's great daughter. The process was this: she, the daughter of a physician, proprietress of the superb equipage you now admired with its confirmatory blasts of trumpet, drum, and cymbal, told you so. On the first day, after taking the small and pleasant dose, you would feel no particular influence beyond a most harmonious sensation of indescribable and irresistible joy. On the second day you would be so astonishingly better that you would think yourself changed into somebody else. On the third day you would be entirely free from disorder, whatever its nature, and however long you had had it, and would seek out the physician's daughter, to throw yourself at her feet, kiss the hem of her garment, and buy as many more of the small and pleasant doses, as by the sale of all your few effects you could obtain. But she would be inaccessible, gone for herbs to the pyramids of Egypt, and you would be ill cured, reduced to despair. Thus would the physician's daughter drive her trade, and briskly too, and thus would the buying and selling and mingling of tongues and colors continue, until the changing sunlight, leaving the physician's daughter in the shadow of high roofs, admonished her to jolt out westward, with a departing effect of gleam and glitter on the splendid equipage and brazen blast. And now the enchanter struck his staff upon the stones of the great place once more, and down went the booths, the sittings and standings, and vanished the merchandise, and with it the barrows, donkeys, donkey carts, and tumbrils, and all other things on wheels and feet, except the slow scavengers with unwieldy carts, and meager horses clearing up the rubbish, assisted by the sleek town pigeons, better plumped out than on non-market days. While there was yet an hour or two to wane before the autumn sunset, the loiterer outside town gate and drawbridge, and postern and double ditch, would see the last white-hooded cart lessening in the avenue of lengthening shadows of trees, or the last country boat, paddled by the last market woman on her way home, showing black upon the reddening, long, low, narrow dike between him and the mill. And as the paddle parted scum and weed closed over the boat's track, he might be comfortably sure that its sluggish rest would be troubled no more until next market day. as it was not one of the great pluses days for getting out of bed, when Mr. the Englishman looked down at the young soldiers practicing the goose step there, his mind was left at liberty to take a military turn. "These fellows are billeted everywhere about," said he, "and to see them lighting the people's fires, boiling the people's pots, minding the people's babies, rocking the people's cradles, washing the people's greens, and making themselves generally useful, in every sort of unmilitary way, is most ridiculous. Never saw such a set of fellows, never did in my life." All perfectly true again. Was there not Private Valentine in that very house, acting as sole housemaid, valet, cook, steward, and nurse, in the family of his captain, Monsieur le Capitaine de la Cour, cleaning the floors, making the beds, doing the marketing, dressing the captain, dressing the dinners, dressing the salads, and dressing the baby, all with equal readiness? Or, to put him aside, he being in loyal attendance on his chief, was there not Private Hippolyte, billeted at the perfumer's 200 yards off, who, when not on duty, volunteered to keep shop, while the fair perfumeress stepped out to speak to a neighbor or so, and laughingly sold soap with his war sword girded on him? Was there not Emil, billeted at the clockmaker's, perpetually turning to of an evening, with his coat off, winding up the stock? Was there not Eugene, billeted at the tinman's, cultivating, pipe in mouth, a garden 4 feet square, for the tinman, in the little court, behind the shop, and extorting the fruits of the earth from the same, on his knees, with the sweat of his brow? Not to multiply examples, was there not Baptist, billeted on the poor water carrier, at that very instant sitting on the pavement in the sunlight, with his martial Lexus under, and one of the water carrier's spare pails between them, which, to the delight and glory of the heart of the water carrier coming across the place from the fountain, yoked and burdened, he was painting bright green outside and bright red within? Or, to go no farther than the barber's at the very next door, was there not Corporal Theophile? "No," said Mr. the Englishman, glancing down at the barber's, "he is not there at present. There's the child, though." A mere mite of a girl stood on the steps of the barber's shop, looking across the place. A mere baby, one might call her, dressed in the close white linen cap which small French country children wear like the children in Dutch pictures, and in a frock of homespun blue, that had no shape except where it was tied round her little fat throat. So that, being naturally short, and round all over, she looked, behind, as if she had been cut off at her natural waist, and had had her head neatly fitted on it. There's the child, though. To judge from the way in which the dimpled hand was rubbing the eyes had been closed in a nap, and were newly opened. But they seemed to be looking so intently across the place, that the Englishman looked in the same direction. "Oh," said he presently, "I thought as much. The corporal's there." The corporal, a smart figure of a man of 30, perhaps a thought under the middle size, but very neatly made, a sunburnt corporal with a brown peaked beard, faced about at the moment, addressing voluble words of instruction to the squad in hand. Nothing was amiss, or awry about the corporal. A lithe and nimble corporal, quite complete, from the sparkling dark eyes under his knowing uniform cap to his sparkling white gaiters. The very image and presentment of a corporal of his country's army, in the line of his shoulders, the line of his waist, the broadest line of his bloomer trousers, and their narrowest line at the calf of his leg. Mr. the Englishman looked on, and the child looked on, and the corporal looked on, but the last named at his men, until the drill ended a few minutes afterwards, and the military sprinkling dried up directly, and was gone. Then said Mr. the Englishman to himself, "Look here. By George." And the corporal, dancing towards the barber's with his arms wide open, caught up the child, held her over his head in a flying attitude, caught her down again, kissed her, and made off with her into the barber's house. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.